This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. It has been 1 month since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And so far, the invasion has resulted in the destruction of cities and millions of refugees. More than 10 million people have been displaced. Earlier this week, UNHCR Chief Filippo Grandi said, quote, "Over the last 4 weeks, the world has watched in disbelief. Countless lives have been lost while millions of others have been completely upended," end quote. Women and children account for 90% of those who have fled. Ukrainian men aged 18 to 60 are eligible for military call-up and cannot leave. UNICEF, the UN's children's agency, said more than 1.5 million children are among those who have been forced to flee. The invasion have also claimed the lives of at least 5 Ukrainian or foreign journalists, definitely including at least 1 Russian journalist. Joining us to discuss coverage is Janine Zachariah, the Carlos Kelly McClatchy Lecturer at Stanford University. Janine is a former Jerusalem Bureau Chief and Middle East Correspondent for The Washington Post. She regularly writes about foreign affairs, the intersection of technology and national security, and media trends for the San Francisco Chronicle, Slate, and other news outlets. Hi, Janine. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Rose.
Well, it's great to have you. This tragic war is a month old, and we are just seeing pictures of destroyed and bombed out neighborhoods and cities. The city of Mariupol is almost unrecognizable. Journalists, so many journalists, as you point out, are there because it's easy to access. And then, of course, social media has played a very important role. What are your thoughts about coverage of the war, given that we are living in such an information flooded environment today?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that's been striking about this, and you just alluded to it, is just how much we're getting in terms of live tweeting, live posting from professional journalists and also citizen journalists, just a lot of different people who are on the ground there. You didn't really have as much of that in some of the other conflict zones. And certainly when I was covering it on the ground, you know, say 10 years ago, you didn't have as much of that. And in the beginning of the invasion in late February, as you mentioned, it was easy for reporters to get into Ukraine, easier than, say, Yemen or Syria in 2012. And so that's led to a lot of coverage. On the flip side, though, now I would say one of the things I'm watching is you have obviously the journalists who have been killed and journalists who've had to be evacuated for security reasons because the Russians are starting to hunt down journalists, especially the Ukrainian journalists. I would say that reporters on the ground are as much an enemy of Vladimir Putin at this point as the Ukrainian military.
Also, I just wanted to point out one recent piece. The New York Times had a piece just a couple of days ago. A Russian journalist who wrote on corruption in her native country was killed in an attack in Kyiv. Anna Balina, a Russian journalist who had reported on government corruption in Russia, was killed in Kyiv while filming the destruction wrought by Russian shelling in the capital, her employer said. And this happened on Wednesday, Janine. She worked for The Insider, an independent investigative news website that is critical of the Kremlin and has been labeled by the Kremlin as a foreign agent.
Yeah, Oksana Balina was her name, and I don't know the details of the exact incident where she was killed, but, you know, I don't know what to say. I mean, at this point, the best thing that we can do is sort of honor her, look at the amazing coverage she did on Russian disinformation and the history of Russia and the Gulag. I mean, she did such incredible work, and I fear that we're only going to see more casualties. But it's imperative that journalists find a way to remain on the ground or to continue to report this remotely. I mean, when it comes to what's happening internally in Russia as well, you've had any independent journalist in Russia has had to flee. That's something that's not being as discussed, I think, as much as, you know, what's happening in Ukraine. But we're going to have a big media blackout inside Russia.
This is such an important point, and I've actually seen some of these Russian journalists who have fled interviewed on the cable shows, and they just talked about how it pretty much happened overnight. They were also very surprised by this invasion, and then they felt like martial law was coming, and so they got out as soon as they could. During the first week of March alone, Russia blocked approximately 30 Russian and Ukrainian independent media sites, according to Nieman reports. So can you also just talk about the importance of independent media in Russia and in Ukraine?
Oh, yeah, it's incredibly important. And I mean, there was a great story the other day. I think it was Jane Aroff who wrote it about, you know, all these Russian journalists sitting like in this cafe in Armenia right now, like trying to figure out their next move. You know, basically, Vladimir Putin criminalized journalism 2 weeks ago, basically criminalized it. People are going to be thrown in jail for very minor, anything they try to post anywhere, anything they say. So it's perilous. And one of the main news organizations on the ground in Ukraine has been the Kyiv Independent. They, you know, in general, when foreign correspondents, American foreign correspondents go to report anywhere, they rely heavily on local news outlets. And I would say the Kyiv Independent has been a standout, but they're all reporting from, they're all being shelled and bombed too. And maybe some of them have to be reporting from underground in subways. I mean, it's such a volatile, dangerous environment at the moment.
And just to let people know what's going on, for those who are maybe not following this as closely, reading from Nieman reports, Putin shuts down Russia's free press for reporting accurately on Ukraine. On the morning of March 4th, the last remaining independent news outlet in Russia, the award-winning Novaya Gazeta, announced the end of its reporting on the war in Ukraine, a new law that bans the dissemination of knowingly false information about the Russian armed forces and carries up to a 15-year penalty was the final blow. The newspaper vowed to continue informing the public about what was happening. This came a day after the independent TV channel Dodds announced a temporary suspension of its broadcast. Over the course of just 1 week, the independent media landscape in Russia has been shuttered. Russian media regulator Roskomnadzor had blocked access to so many sites, MediaZone, Medusa, The New Times, Doxa, The Village. I mean, the list is just so long, Janine.
Yeah, it's long. And so what you're going to have now is a situation, though, where some people in Russia who want to access credible information and not Russian propaganda are going to find ways with Tor and other technical abilities to like access news from abroad. But it's going to be harder. And the Russian journalists who've had to flee are going to be just like the Afghan journalists who fled a few months ago, or the Syrian journalists who had to flee, and they're going to have to do remote reporting, which they'll, I mean, look, the majors here, our major news outlets are well-sourced in Russia and these other places. But one of the things they're going to have to take into consideration is, will we put people at risk by interviewing them? How do we protect sources on the ground that will agree to talk to us, given the crackdown, the monitoring of anybody who tries to communicate with a foreign journalist?
Right. And I haven't seen this question answered yet, but I just wonder, are these Russian journalists going to be able to return?
Who knows?
Right.
I mean, not as long as Putin's there. I mean, I don't think. I mean, such a major cataclysm. I mean, look, but here's the thing. Vladimir Putin was, journalists have been thrown out of down stairwells, thrown out of windows in Russia for a very long time. Assassinations, I mean, all these things. And it was kind of like it was just sort of something that would be discussed at the State Department when they did like the Press Freedom Report. But these are all signs that, you know, of trying to silence any credible reporting about the country, push his own narrative. At a minimum now, at least people are aware exactly what's going on, taking it seriously.
And according to this piece, international media, CNN, BBC, Bloomberg, ABC, they've been forced to suspend their operations in Russia. And Janine, I was thinking about what happens with Fox and families. We did shows about this, where you've got a family member or family members only watching Fox. One of the reporters from Medusa was on MSNBC and said his own family members who are still in Russia are not believing how horrific this is. They're not believing that certain cities are just being bombed and that millions and millions of people are fleeing because of the propaganda that they are watching.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think Julia Yaffe made this point on the other day in an interview. Like, people say, how can the Russians not see what's happening? They're bombing holy hell out of Ukraine. Like, how can they not see it? How do they believe this stuff about the Nazis, fighting the Nazis? And then people say, well, have you seen that 40% of Americans think that Trump won the election in 2020? And so I think it does require a little bit of understanding of how you know, propaganda works. You've seen this very much in China as well. I mean, China, I mean, there was, you know, a really scary story over the weekend about just how effective China's been at silencing any credible media and pushing one line. I mean, this is a growing trend with the growing authoritarianism around the world.
Today, we are talking about media coverage of Russia's invasion of Ukraine with Janine Zachariah, the Carlos Kelly McClatchy Lecturer at Stanford University. She teaches classes on journalism, and she's a former Jerusalem Bureau Chief and Middle East Correspondent for The Washington Post. If you'd like to talk about what has struck you about media coverage of this invasion and the crackdown on the media, so many Russian journalists fleeing Russia, the information, the social media, the images coming out of Ukraine, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. And let's hear from Mark in Berkeley. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much for the show. I wanted to say that I am completely in agreement with the guest. I mean, the behavior of Putin and the Russian military on the ground is horrific. I'm against the wars. But I am also critical of the media. The media has been pretty much in lockstep, sort of acting like one day Russia just decided to get up and attack the Ukraine. There are real security issues involved, and there's been really bad behavior on both sides. The present president of Ukraine, Zelensky, was elected in 2019 to implement the Minsk Accords, which was hammered out by both Russia, Ukraine, the OSCE, and the Donbass leaders, and he has not done that. And so there's been a hot war on the border of Russia and the Donbass for over 8 years, and you never hear anything about that, but, you know, it's a horrific situation, and this was not going to continue. Something had to happen. And just lastly, I just want to say that we have right-wingers, we have Nazi people that are involved in some of our National Guards and all that kind of thing. The history of Ukraine, because of their many, many decades of oppression from Poland, from Germany, from Russia, they have a much more serious right-wing element in their National Guard, and they do not like Russians, and you know, so there is a real security situation going on there that we need more information about.
Well, thank you for that. This is something that we'd have to really look at and fact check, Janine. Any comments on this? There's been that. What he just said at the end has been getting a lot of people have been saying this over and over again. Can you comment?
Who's on the
that?
People? Which people, Rose? Who's saying this? This is sort of the right wing propaganda that is, you know, in lockstep with Vladimir Putin, right? I mean, so I mean, I appreciate the call, but whatever. Even let's say he was right. I mean, which he's not. But like, so does the caller agree? Is he watching what's happening with this Russian's attacks on civilians across the entire country? You know, does he see the lies about Zelensky's a Nazi? Zelensky's grandparents were killed. You know, his family was killed in the Holocaust. You know what I mean? Like, it's just on the face of it, very basically, right? I mean, they went in, they took over the Donbass. Russia thinks it's their point of view, that their territory, right? So, I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, but I think in terms of the media being lockstep, I've actually been really impressed with the way U.S. media have been covering this in terms of actually committing resources to doing, they understand the magnitude of the story. We are at risk not only of Ukraine being taken control of, but we could see a Russian attack on a NATO ally, which would draw us, the United States, into a war with a Russia that is putting its nuclear forces on high alert. That is the story that we need to be talking about right now.
Hmm. What are your thoughts, though, Janine? I mean, there's so much information and misinformation out there, a lot of lies out there. And in this media age, you know, again, people can get information from certain sources that are completely just not true. So what are your thoughts about that? Because that has exploded after this invasion of Ukraine.
You know what my thoughts are, Rose? People need to listen to you and your call radio. And I mean, they need to listen to public trusted media because, you know, it's the best, most credible source of news that you can get right now. People need to understand that they need to resume some kind of smart news consumption. If you're a person who gets your news primarily by just scrolling through your Facebook page and reading what people are posting, that is not a healthy news diet. Same thing, just sitting and scrolling through Instagram or Twitter. Seek out credible fact-based news sources. I mean, reporters, like, if you don't like the New York Times or the Washington Post and you think it's too liberal or whatever, even though they have some of the most sensational foreign correspondents, I mean, their international coverage is incredible. You know, then just read the AP. Okay, because if we didn't have the AP, the Associated Press, on the ground in Mariupol, we would not have known exactly what was going on there. And unfortunately, those reporters have had to evacuate too. I'm glad to see that, unlike in 2016, there is more awareness about Russian disinformation. There's more discernment of, you know, what's being proposed online. Be very skeptical, everyone, of the images you're seeing online, even from, you know, pro-Ukrainian accounts, Russian accounts. You have to think to yourself, is this image authentic? Was it really from this incident it's claiming? And we all, unfortunately, have to be, you know, just very skeptical about images at this moment.
Right. Well, and to your point about the AP and Mariupol, this was an incredible piece. I hope everyone can take the time to read it. 20 Days in Mariupol, the team that documented the city's agony. It starts by saying the Russians were hunting us down. They had a list of names, including ours, and they were closing in. We were the only international journalists left in Mariupol, and we'd been documenting its siege by Russian troops for more than 2 weeks. And the AP just this morning, Jane, reports that Ukraine says 300 people died in the Mariupol theater attack, and hunger is gripping that city.
It's the most important piece that's come out in the last week. Everybody needs to read it. Maybe you guys can put it on the website or something.
Yeah, we definitely will. What about, Jane? I mean, you've been a longtime correspondent, a longtime war correspondent. We had Eric Regulli on last week, who is the bureau chief correspondent for the Globe and Mail, based in Rome. He just wrote a book about his father, who was a journalist in Vietnam. He was a prominent Canadian journalist. And he talked about the level of freedom his father had in covering the war without being censored, and how different it is today. What strikes you about how this war has been covered compared to other invasions, occupations like Syria, Iraq, and Yemen?
Yeah, I mean, I think first thing I was thinking when this all started, you know, late February, I mean, obviously the buildup preceded that, was, oh my God, this is going to be Aleppo all over. It's like Aleppo, which, if for the, you know, people don't recall, you know, the Russians were bombing, supporting President Bashar al-Assad with devastating bombings throughout Syria, especially in Aleppo, in 2015, or thereabouts. And, you know, it was the kind of thing where there was some coverage, but coverage of Syria was episodic. For example, when you had the picture of the baby Island Kurdi, a 3-year-old who rushed up, you know, unfortunately died and tragically and washed up on a Turkish beach. And then everybody will talk about Syria for a few days. Right. So it was very episodic. Now, one of the reasons that you didn't have as much coverage in Syria, though, as you did now, is it was harder for journalists to get in there. And as I told Stanford News the other day, the preeminent Middle East correspondent of our time, Anthony Shadid, died in 2012, secretly exiting Syria, like on a horseback. He was allergic to horses. I mean, that was how hard it was to get in and out of Syria at that time. With Yemen and these kinds of places, which, you know, conflict, famine, my former colleague Sudarshan Raghavan for The Washington Post, like, he can only get in every couple months. Like, it's hard to get a visa. And so it's somewhat limiting. And then there's the issue of, you know, it's just become extremely dangerous. My last big story was covering the Arab revolutions in 2011. And then I moved to teach at Stanford. And shortly after that, it just became too dangerous. I mean, you had Marie Colvin in 2012. People might remember her. She had an eye patch on one of her eyes. She was an outstanding international reporter. And Bashar al-Assad targeted her. You know, she was killed, you know, along with her French reporting partner at the time. And, you know, you had then reporters who were executed by ISIS, and the whole thing of foreign correspondence has become very dangerous. And one of the things that I hope that the listeners will appreciate after watching, now we've lost 5 journalists in a month, and I'm unfortunately certain there will be more, especially among those who don't have a big news organization like the Washington Post or security teams backing them up and are basically freelancing, is just the risks journalists are taking. Right. It's we should be very appreciative of that.
I also want to ask you just about, and this has been getting some coverage, but I think it deserves a lengthier story, about covering the refugees who are Europeans versus refugees from Africa, Middle East, the North Africa, Afghanistan. I mean, this is a crisis around the world. And the Arab and Middle East Journalist Association put out a statement calling on news organizations to be wary of ascribing, quote, more importance to some victims of war over others, end quote. Janine, you've talked about this. I mean, they cite so many examples out there. The CBS correspondent commenting on Ukraine and Kyiv that, quote, this isn't a place with all due respect like Iraq or Afghanistan. This is a relatively civilized, relatively European city, who then apologized for saying that. Even an Al Jazeera anchor said, these are not people trying to get away from areas in North Africa. They look like any European family that you would live next door to. What are your thoughts on all of this?
I mean, obviously, it was cringeworthy, some of these comments. And thankfully, the CBS reporter apologized after that. What I think he should have said, though, was, you know, what you're seeing now happening in Ukraine is exactly the kind of attacks that we had for years by Russia in Syria. And we did not cover that as much as we should have, you know what I mean? And in such a sustained and concerted way, part of the reasons, and then explain everything that I've said. And, you know, I think we have to, it's true that we don't have as much coverage of some of these things, or if we're covering refugee crises, it's through a certain lens. I mean, I do think we did cover the Syrian refugee crisis in terms of, especially when they had all these drownings off the coast of Greece, as you recall, Rose. I mean, there was coverage of that. And I don't think, you know, frankly, there's not sustained coverage of any international issue right now. Right. And that's because a lot of our media, CNN, MSNBC, Fox, whatever, the networks, and that are for-profit media. And again, that's why it's important to support local media, or if you really want this kind of coverage, you need to demand it and you need to pay for it because it's expensive. There's no correlation in what we cover, the scope of a humanitarian disaster and the amount of coverage a story gets in the U.S. media. This has been documented. People can look at the research of Andrew Shaver at UC Merced. He's written papers on this. And that's something that I would like to figure out how to change. And that's one of the things I'm working on at Stanford. How do we tell these stories in a way that people in the United States will consume them and understand the scope of what's happening in countries in Africa? What's happening in Tigray right now? How often have you seen, Rose, a story about Tigray on CNN right now? You know, like, they're just not doing it. Right.
You really have to search for it. And then you can find great reporting, but you really have to look for it.
No, the reporting is there. And this is what people need to not be passive news consumers, because the editors who make the decisions on programming are not centering the story. However, there is extraordinary reporting being done on all of these issues. You just have to look for it.
Exactly. I mean, I just searched right now for Tigray, and I should say we have not covered this yet, and I'm glad you brought it up because we need to. New York Times, Ethiopia declares humanitarian truce in war-ravaged Tigray. Of course, Al Jazeera is covering this. What are you exploring on this, Jane, in our final minute? I mean, what are some of the things you're looking at to ensure that this actually gets better?
Well, I think it's important to, in a way, shame the networks into doing this, right? And sort of say, you know, I mean, I look, when an anchor, you know, does something like and says, oh, my God, look at this, they're only covering Ukraine because it's in Europe. Well, is that anchor pushing their editors to do more of these other stories? Right. I mean, we need to explain, like, why it's important to understand international news. And there are tools for doing that. People like single character narratives. Most of the listeners probably saw the video of the little girl singing Frozen in an underground shelter or in the subway or wherever she was, right? Like, we have to vehicles, ways into these stories that are accessible, but that everybody comes out better informed.
It's so true. And if MSNBC sent a correspondent to Tigray, I'm sure that would get so much attention.
Well, they have to do the story in a way that people understand, how does this affect me? I hope that people see that what's happening everywhere is affecting us, right? I mean, this war is affecting us, and it has a potential, unfortunately, to affect us in an even more severe way in the weeks to come.
Janine Zachariah is the Carlos Kelly McClatchy Lecturer at Stanford University. She teaches journalism classes, and she's a former Jerusalem Bureau Chief and Middle East Correspondent for The Washington Post. And you can find her work at yourcallradio.org. Janine, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rose.
Thank you. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. And you can find the stories that we mentioned today at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.